And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm happy to welcome Scott McClanahan to the program today. Scott is a writer from West Virginia whose approach to writing and life would never be called timid. He's released several collections of stories, but he's probably best known for his book, Crapalachia. His newest release is a novel called The Sarah Book, which features a writer named Scott McClanahan who is doing his best to ruin his marriage to a woman named Sarah, and examines the beginning of their relationship as well as its demise. Now, Scott, it says at the very beginning of the book, portions of this book have been plagiarized. So, which parts?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's tons of stuff in there. Probably the funniest one is there's a Limp Bizkit song. There's the line, he said, she said, bullshit. And there's he said, she said, in the book. But I just did that for my wife because she thought it was funny. Because she was going to read one of the chapters in the draft. And I was like, I'll just put a bunch of Limp Bizkit references through this whole chapter. And I took most of them out. But I left that one in. I'm trying to think what it, I mean, there's tons of stuff in there. There's a book by Bulgakov, the Russian writer, wrote about, he's known for Master and Margarita. There's a biography that he wrote of Molière. I think there's probably whole sentences that I stripped from his Molière book and put into the Sarah book. Especially that one section where the Scott character is going with his mom to the candy store. You know, the Sarah character's working at the candy store, and then the little boy would grow up to write this book that's taken from the Bulgakov. And I mean, I could go on and on. Plagiarism is a good business.
Well, before we were talking about translation, so you're actually plagiarizing as translator.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, for sure. So, and I've always kind of liked books like that. And books have always done that, I think. I just read this book of essays by Guy Davenport called Geography Imagination. Talking about the modernist writers, Joyce or Pound or whoever, essentially in some ways kind of plagiarizing the ancient Greeks, ancient Romans, without even necessarily knowing that they're doing that, thinking they're being incredibly hyper-modern, but really they're just kind of reiterating something that, you know, Heraclitus or whoever said in 5th century BC Greece. So I've always sort of done that. And the sample, Kieran and I were driving down here and, you know, he was talking about Black Keys record, you know, Junior Kimbrough songs. Like, music does that all the time. And poetry does it all the time, too, in some ways. Shelley's poem, Ozymandias, which I was reading in the Guy Davenport book. Shelley had a friend, it was like a lawyer, I want to say, who'd written this poem. They'd do this, I guess, in their free time for kicks at parties, where a friend would write the poem, and then Shelley would counter that. And that's where Ozymandias came from. He wrote that poem in 5 minutes as a goof on the poem that his friend had just written, which is incredibly similar to Ozymandias. Basically has the same kind of thesis statement to it as well. That's kind of a thing, you know, great Kathy Acker, you know, her whole entire career is kind of built around the plagiarizing of texts and changing the context of the text by placing it somewhere else. But really, I guess what I meant by that in the book is the way, like, our own stories tied up with other stories, or the way our own stories connected to another person's story, and in some ways by telling your story you're kind of plagiarizing the other person's story. So hopefully that thing kind of works on about 5 or 6 different levels, maybe not just one. And it's also a good joke up front that it's plagiarized to begin with. It keeps people on their toes.
Do you think people are a little too complacent when they read?
Yeah, exactly. You want to kind of punch them in the face a little bit, I think, especially with the written word. Because it's such a kind of intimate sort of experience. I think that's the reason why I've always loved books. It's like nothing more. I mean, even when you're watching a movie, you're being manipulated in a similar sense in, you know, watching a piece of cinema. But, you know, those images are coming towards you, right? Somebody's already created those images. And with books, you're trying to, you're entering into the person. The poet's controlling your breath, your voice. You know, the writer's helping to, you know, fashion images in your mind, but you're the one who's creating those images in your mind. So that's such a kind of sacred sort of experience that we really take for granted. And the books that I've always loved have kind of played around with that notion.
Are you trying to manipulate yourself or the reader?
Yeah, probably more just myself. Like, I don't even think of a reader. I mean, I see Tom Clancy books around. You know, I'm sure Tom Clancy was thinking of his reader, right? And God bless that, you know, that relationship between, you know, mass market paperback, you know, writer of, you know, thrillers or whatever, and that particular readership. But for me, I mean, my readership's always, like, been me. It's been what I've wanted to do in the books. And it's been a way just to entertain myself, even. So, yeah,
In the book, Scott is frustrated with the students in his class saying they only want to know if characters are good or bad.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I can kind of like shake my head at that and, you know, hate students who do that. But we do that all the time. I mean, that's just the nature of things.
What do you tend to be reductive about?
Even from my own perspective, like, I love writers who are sociopaths, or psychopaths, you know, Sir Thomas Malory or French poet, you know, Villon, right? And, you know, murderers. They're immediately more interesting to me than someone who, John Dryden or whoever, you know, lived a relatively quiet life and dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's. So, same with that, you know, and saying the students saying whether or not they're good or bad people, typically they're erring on the side of wanting everybody to be a good person and a good character. Whereas I do kind of the exact opposite in that. But I think that's a problem with, like, our culture in general now is going through, like, this weird sort of new Puritanism almost, where there's an element of, like, social justice to people's work, where even authors are wanting you to know, like, I am a good person. I immediately, like, distrust that, you know? That person who's telling you to trust me is usually the person you got to watch out for. I was rereading back in the spring the Brontes, and I think that's the reason why Emily, like, Wuthering Heights is so fascinating still, because there's no, virtually no comment made. Like, Heathcliff is a horrible person, right? A horrible character, but I don't think Bronte's really telling you that, right? She's just presenting these little images for you to encounter. So, yeah, I mean, that's one of the bad things about, I guess, teaching in some ways, but it's just the nature of the business.
Is it really a new Puritanism, or is it just we're constantly evolving our way on what we judge?
Exactly, and I think that's, you know, probably, you know, it has to do quite a bit with, you know, social media being a part of it as well. But, yeah, it's just these kind of old sort of, you know, judgmental, you know, almost Victorian type. Not to knock the Victorians, because I think they're a lot more complex, too, than we like to pretend they are. But, like, even, you know, pre-Raphaelites, like, I love the pre-Raphaelites, and they don't fit into that box of, you know, Victorianism stereotypes. But, yeah, I think that's kind of natural for readerships. I've noticed I was in this thing called the Tournament of Books. Do you know that thing?
Is it the Millions?
Yeah, and it's like they select all these books, and then it's like this real popular thing, and everybody, it's kind of like a book club. And then each week, once the tournament begins, a judge, they pair books up together with one another, and one wins and one loses, and then there's
a critique.
It's
like a basketball bracket.
Yeah, it's like a basketball bracket. And I was in that one time, and I noticed that, and it appeals to, I guess, I don't, again, want to misspeak here, but, you know, kind of soccer mom type mentality a lot of times, and most of, you know, most of the new Goodreads type reviews that you would get from those people would all be about, like, you know, I don't like this person, or these characters are unlikable, and, you know, all that sort of junk, which I'm completely against, have no interest or use for.
So do you think the ultimate sin is to be boring?
Yeah, maybe so. There's another stolen thing. That's Joe Strummer. That's a plagiarized Joe Strummer line. It only sins the bore people.
In that way, when you find, like, Malory fascinating, do you find him in the of himself fascinating, or the fact that he contravenes the conventions of the time fascinating?
Yeah, well, that's what's so strange, too, about these individuals and kind of, like, the works, too, you know, like, do I really love, like, the poetry of Shelley, or do I love the myth of Shelley? You know, do I really love Poe, or do I love the image I was spoon-fed as, you know, a junior high student of who Poe was? And you could probably do that with it, you know, with any artist, you know, whether it's a blues artist or a painter or whoever. You know, the myth almost becomes as important as the work. So yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know how to answer that. Probably both.
How about artists who don't have a whole lot of knowledge about their biography available? Say, like a Pynchon or in music. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Have you heard of Jandek?
Yeah, exactly.
So how much does the myth of ignorance, is that important?
For sure, and I guess that's the reason why we're still, you know, Sappho, right? You know, that's the reason why Sappho is still fascinating to us, because, like, who is this person? And I guess some of the same thing, you know, with Shakespeare. It's almost like this Dylan-like quality that certain authors have where, you know, the lack of biography creates more sort of interest in the work or who the individual is. And for sure, you know, with Pynchon, like, I've heard stories that he was in Mexico at the same time as Lee Harvey Oswald, right? Then possibly they could have even been on the same bus going to New Orleans. That sort of, you know, mythology. And probably the reality is, you know, Pynchon was, He's a chemistry student, right? That probably tells us a whole lot about who this guy was, even in the books. You know, he's living in Southern California or California during a particular period of time. And he's a writer, so probably he's living a pretty mundane, boring sort of existence. I'd watched a documentary a couple of weeks ago. It was this BBC documentary from the early 90s, and this was someone, a girl who dated Pynchon is in this documentary, and she said that she first met him at a bookstore, but she met his sister. But then she realized that his sister was him, because I guess he would show up to this bookstore wearing a wig and with makeup on.
There's an echo of that in the book.
Exactly, there is an echo, just to entertain himself, even. So, yeah, good old Thomas Pynchon.
But then you have an artist like composer Charles Ives, who ran an insurance business, but
yeah,
just made
sure.
This amazing, crazy art.
Yeah, I guess that's the cliche, you know, the Flaubert, you know, line too. And Charles Ives, there's a bunch of essays in that Guy Davenport book about Charles Ives, or, you know, the William Carlos Williams sort of example of these very mundane sort of professions that are allowing this very strange stuff to happen to. You know, a doctor making house calls, that seems so boring, but a doctor making house calls who's stopping on the way to jot down this strange little images poem. That's wild that that was happening right in front of somebody and they didn't even realize it. They probably just thought they were meeting a really nice New Jersey doctor, you know.
I remember reading this book a few years ago called The Art of Travel, and it talked about Flaubert's trip to Egypt.
Yeah.
And his buddy that went with him talked about how such a terrible traveler Flaubert was. He was a whiner. He complained about everything. He was miserable.
Yeah, don't they pick up venereal disease there too? Isn't there? So I think Flaubert might have picked up venereal disease.
Flaubert wrote so glowingly about it, but it seemed like he had the most miserable time on the trip itself.
Yeah.
How close is the Scott McClanahan in the book to the writer Scott McClanahan, and how close are both of those to the person that's sitting in front of me right now?
It's one of those traps you make for yourself. Because I believe, like, I can't stand novels. Maybe that's a lie. I mean, I read tons of them. But, you know, there's that David Shields reality hunger where, you know, readers are more interested in that concept of reality, which the novel used to provide for us now. But almost as we've created these conventions of the novel where a reader has distance from the book, and most books I read, they just seem real kind of fake. It's like, you know, even my friends, it's like, this is a book that you're imagining as a television show, or, you know, this is a book where you're wanting to get across certain ideas. So early on, I made these fictions about myself, and that's what's always so kind of weird about it. Like, you know, I kind of write about real people in a way. Some people are composites, some people aren't. But yet, I'll kind of make up stories around them as well. So probably the easy answer would be, I guess it's all of those things, right? Some ways it's me, some ways it's not me, some ways it's just a fiction, simply because I knew that it's just a natural way of storytelling. If you say, like, this happened to me, you're immediately more interested than if I said, you know, I have this friend named Joe, right? And Joe had this happen. And, you know, somebody robbed Joe last week. There's a distance and a certain amount of boredom with that than if you said, I was robbed, right? I got robbed last week. And that's been, like, the instinct that I've always had in my work, to make something that appears on the surface to be personal. It appears on the surface to be almost true, right? Like an autobiography. But, you know, that's, yeah, great fiction. And even our great memoirs, like, I don't know, Rousseau's Confessions, you know, he doesn't go in the reality that he's, you know, making his wife give up all of these babies, right? Baby after baby after baby that they're taking to the orphanage. He makes it into this heroic life, right? He makes it into this, you know, fiction of the individual leading this, you know, life of the mind. So I guess that would be my answer to that question.
But with the fictionalized elements that you put in the book, as opposed to the things that actually happened, are you searching for a truth, or are you just looking for a good story?
I'm looking for a story, which I think is the truth. Like, there's epiphanies, and I always want there to be some sort of dramatic irony or some sort of epiphany or some sort of, in some ways, almost, you know, a thesis in kind of a general sort of sense. And I guess most of the thesis in all of my stories is, like, you believe something's one way, but it's just the opposite, right? And you think something's going to occur, and it turns out that it doesn't happen that way. You know, that's most of the things that I've that I've written about, but I want it to be like inherent within the action, right? I want it to be inherent within the story that I'm telling and not to be told like with some sort of truth or message or anything along those lines. I'm not interested in any of that.
Now, the first real paragraph of the book is, there's only one thing I know about life. If you live long enough, you start losing things. Things get stolen from you. First, you lose your youth, and then your parents, and then you lose your friends, and finally, you end up losing yourself.
Yeah, that's another plagiarized part, now that you mention that, which is taken from Kris Kristofferson. There's a Kris Kristofferson documentary I saw where he was saying that. And he was stealing it from featherweight champion Willie Pep from back in the 50s, who used to say that about the reflexes. I think that stuff at the end about losing yourself, like, that's mine. Like, I added that to it. And I guess that's, like, the great tragedy with everything, right? That you end up losing yourself after all this other crap that you go through. That's incredibly strange to think, you know, all of us here in this room, we have our little hearts are beating bumpity-bump, and, you know, we have our consciousness, and you're not going to be able to communicate that at one point in time, or at least we believe, possibly, that you're not going to be able to communicate that. So I guess maybe that's what the books are for.
But at least in this book, Scott's not losing things. Scott's throwing things away.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I guess there is some, you know, irony, you know, some irony with what you're setting up as, you know, what the book's about. But yeah, for sure.
Something about all those little hearts and each of us that are sitting in this room.
Yeah.
There's a part where he's driving drunk.
Yeah.
And he says, we're all just a few feet from one another. We're just a few feet from finding out the physics of death.
Yeah.
And that's just not in cars.
Yeah,
because,
exactly.
I mean,
it's
I could jump across the table and
yeah,
try to
exactly.
kill you right now.
You know, well, there's concept of the handshake, right? Isn't that history class 101, right? Where they start kind of telling you these things that we do on a daily basis that have no meaning anymore, but at one point in time was to, you know, show you, like, I do not have a weapon, right? I'm not going to stab you with my sword. I'm extending my hand in the various behaviors that we have like that. What was the question again? I think I forgot.
I don't even think it was a question. I was just commenting on, we are always so close to each other, not just in cars, but in our daily lives.
Exactly.
That, I mean, violence could break out at any moment.
And not only violence in that way, but the way relationships work. I mean, my parents have been married now, I don't know, they're probably on their fourth decade of marriage or getting close to it. It's been a battle, right? I think that's been, any relationship that you have is a battle in some way, a glorious sort of battle. I don't know who's won between them. You know, I used to think my father was, like, so strong, but then I realized, like, no, he's, like, the weak one. Like, he might be the hyper-masculine individual within our household, but the person who is, like, the strength is my little 5'1" mother, right? And that sort of violence, which I think is always so strange in our society, the way we comment on violence. Being passive aggressive can be pretty rough on somebody's, you know, central nervous system as well, if you know, take 40 years of that. So, yeah.
It's a pet theory of mine that about 90% of all actions that we take are just neutral, maintaining inertia of our lives.
Yeah.
And then we got about 10% we could either split into a good or a bad.
Yeah.
Have some type of moral dimension to it.
Yeah, yeah.
And moral luck plays a big part, because when the book really starts going, Scott is bragging about being the world's best drunk driver.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's only that because of moral luck, because some bad circumstance hasn't inserted its way into his path.
For sure. Or even kind of flipping that, right? I mean, we always look at these things as being, like, hyper negative. And we always look at, like, alcoholism as being this, you know, this negative thing, where I've known tons of people who are alcoholics and they became a lot less interesting, and they become a little bit more grumpy when they get sober.
Dry drinks.
You know, the alcohol itself is almost kind of religious sacrament rather than just this self-destructive sort of BS that we typically tend to look at it as. You know, and I guess that's what the book does too. And I guess what's kind of what all my books have done now that I start thinking about it. You know, you take this negative, and it is a negative, and it creates this sort of, I don't know, Huckleberry Finn, Mark Twain sort of irony throughout it, where we're speaking about it in this kind of offhand sort of way, but there's a gravity towards what's happening. But yeah, you know, celebrating these kind of negative things in our lives, like celebrating our pain and our end of a relationship, and celebrating, you know, the horrible stuff that happened to you as kids, like, maybe that's very American too. feels, you know, very romantic.
I think showing off your scars is a universal thing.
Yeah, and also, is that a trap? You know, do you create a trap for yourself by that? You know, there's that Leonard Cohen quote, you know, it's easier to show a scar than a pimple, which I think is true. You know, it's easier to say I was arrested and sent to prison for 10 years than I'm a really kind of nasty, self-righteous individual, right? Something that you wouldn't necessarily see on the surface. That's harder to admit. That's harder to show. So even in this kind of confessional aspect, you have tons of books like that. My book's by no means a confession. It's not anything like that. But, you know, the confession usually always feels like a lie. Like the thing they're confessing shouldn't probably be the thing that they should be confessing. It's not that they spent 10 years in prison or they went through this horrible drug experience, but that they're full of vanity and have to tell you about it, right? That's the real confession that usually, you know, people don't get to.
Well, Scott seems to be pretty open with us,
mm-hmm.
but what do you think are some of the things that he's hiding from us amongst that openness?
Yeah, maybe just like this, just kind of self-regard, right? Totally being about the self. Which I guess you have to be as an author. It's a weird little, like, sociopathic sort of function, you know, of making these little books. And probably within, you know, at least the non-fictional sort of elements of that Scott character, probably just making a book probably destroys the relationship as much as a lie or, you know, alcoholism or whatever you want to say. Just sitting in your room or sitting downstairs for hours upon hours during the day and making something for whatever reason. So yeah, maybe that, hiding the fact that, there's an element of like, not only like exploitation when you're a storyteller of the people that you know, but there's also an element of, you know, you shut yourself off from those people in order to, you know, write, in order to express who you are, which is incredibly strange.
So where do you think you're the most honest?
Oh, well, again, I think I'd probably like question like the honest stuff. I don't know. I think what pops in my head is I think the narrative of, like, I don't think there's an honest leg in any of the book. I hear that all the time, but I don't think there's honesty in that sort of stuff. But there's an honesty, I think, in the structure of the thing. Maybe like this very Flaubert type answer to give. But I think there's an honesty in that structure of the way stories work, of the way relationships work, of the way that stories about relationships work, and the way that past events bounce off of current events, that are influencing that sort of event. And the structure, too, I guess the structure I've stolen. I wanted to write, like, you know, Dante's Inferno or, you know, like a Divine Comedy, and it has three parts. You have this guy who's about 30, right, midway through his life. You have this kind of Beatrice figure in the character of Sarah. You have, well, do we have a Virgil? Yeah, we have a Virgil in, like, the talking chicken wings. So all those elements are there, and maybe I'm just kind of copying that structure. Everything is in tens. You know, Dante's obsessed with the tens. Even if you count most of the paragraphs within the chapter, you're going to come up with 10, or you very easily could come up with 10 if it's not broken off by dialogue or something like that. So yeah, who knows about the honesty thing? But I think there's an honesty in the structure of that book. I read novels all the time, right? And you know they are. There's these kind of great manipulators in the way that, you know, something twists, right? A Hitchcock film, you know, something twists. You're led down this pathway of a lie, and so that it can twist, and so that you can believe this other lie now that they're constructing. And I think that the structure of the book doesn't really lend itself to that. The way it builds in each section, if it does, I think it builds in the first section. I think it builds a little bit in the third section. I think the second section, I could have taken a chapter or two out, and it would have flowed a little bit better. Yeah, I mean, I think it kind of presents stories the way we tell them, the way we live them.
And I think the title of the book is a bit of a lie.
Yeah.
And Sarah's book, it's more of the book of Sarah.
Yeah, yeah. Or even, you know, by the end, you know, the Scott character is Sarah. And, you know, he's wearing her clothes. He's putting on her makeup. And even the next chapter, right, he's looking at his face, and it's not his face anymore. It's that other face. In the same way, though, that you can flip that. And, you know, the Sarah characters become Scott, right? Which, yeah, I mean, I think that's true, right? People cause you pain, or that physics of death that you live side by side with, right? You become a person in a way. You become an element of that person. Maybe.
And then there's the quote, why doesn't anyone hallucinate about how they work at a grocery store?
Yeah, exactly, right? It was just so strange where people, you know, paranoid schizophrenics, I guess, have, you know, I had an uncle who's paranoid schizophrenic, and his, you know, his hallucinations were, you know, always kind of religious in some ways. Or drug experiences, right? Or, you know, our drug experiences are like religious in a way. When, yeah, why doesn't the human brain function in a different way? Where I'm neither Jesus, I'm not the devil either, but I'm somebody's, you know, kid sister, right? Who's into television or you know
it's past life regression is like always right. A king or a queen.
It's always Cleopatra, right? Yeah. Somebody's always been Cleopatra when it comes down to it, and maybe that's kind of a self protection that we have too, right? Maybe the brain's trying to protect itself in that way. It's trying to tell you that it's trying to tell you, you know, that it's important. It's trying to tell you, you know, that ego's coming out in those things. It's trying to say that, you know, your existence is important when it very well may not be.
It's definitely very small.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess it's kind of like the brio that small dogs have.
Yeah, exactly. And even this stuff, you know, this podcast or the book that I wrote, there's the, you know, the great anecdote of, you know, the writer who's going to used bookstore and his book's, you know, been out 5 years or whatever, and he sees his book in the used bookstore and he pulls down the book and he looks at the inscription. It says, to Mom and Dad, you always supported me, right? Mom and Dad's taking his book to the used bookstore. You know, these things are going to be poof, right? Off the air, like, you know, or off the earth, gone from us and will matter to no one eventually. And so, you know, that interest in the energy of reading a story that's right in front of you, that's always, you know, kind of got my juices flowing.
So facing that cosmic insignificance that we have, why do you go ahead and create?
I have a friend, poet Heather Crystal, and I asked her about this quote. She just sent it to me the other day. I read an interview with her. She's an amazing poet. She's one of the best poets alive today. And she was talking about that when you read, you're alive, right? Reading is, you know, something given to the living, right? Writing, though, is the flip side of that, right? Like, writing is death. Writing is communicating what you were, who you were, after you're gone. It's this strange sort of time machine that you wrap yourself up in, and the hope that somebody's gonna pull that book up and is gonna have some sort of experience of your experience that, you know, you had. And that's the hope, right? I went to Square Books yesterday, right, and it's all Faulkner stuff. That's what I was telling my wife. It's like, there's no, it's like, did he create this? And I guess that's always, that's like the Harold Bloom question in Shakespeare too, right? This dude create this place, right? Was it really like this when Faulkner's bumping around Oxford in 1917 or 1929? Or was it always like this? And there's probably a little bit of both, you know, that mirror that you hold up to a place. Well, you know, it's also reflected back at, you know, it's something else as well, right? But at the same time, with that said, it's totally kind of fake, right? Like, a Faulkner universe is the mind of one human being, right? The mind of one individual. And that's all that ever existed. And we're just seeing little kind of images of it from that mind of a single individual. And what it comes down to, there's a part at the end of that Walk the Line, right? Johnny Cash film where, you know, his dad is trying to talk to the grandchildren. He's like, tell them how you got us on the boat and took us across during the flood. And that's what's so weird to think, like, little Billy Faulkner had a mom, right? And he had a dad and he had brothers and they loved one another. And, like, these people existed. That's what's, I think, even more strange is that this guy, you know, he existed with all artists that we look at, right? So, yeah, I don't know where I started with that, but, man, I went somewhere far away.
I mean, people can have profound effects on a culture because the guy who wrote the Pledge of Allegiance did not put Under God in it originally, and he was a Baptist minister who wrote it.
Yeah.
And then they only put it in during the Red Scare.
Yeah.
And people who think this grand statement is an essence of humanity, of Americanness, is less than 100 years old and has been altered a couple of times over its course, but everyone thinks what we do now is what it is.
Yeah, exactly. So I think I've always looked at the books as kind of a practical thing, like, you know, what Chaucer says or Montaigne, or of just like, I'm just leaving something for my kids or my grandkids. Like, that's it. I've published them. I'm wondering now, like, why I've done this. Like, I could have just written them. But I don't think I would have had the book, though, that I had if I hadn't gone through the back and forth with an editor, right? I would have created a much different manuscript. You know, the book becomes the book because also of a readership that encounters the book. So I've always just kind of looked at them as these little practical things for Sam and ours and grandkids in some ways, which feels kind of backwards and primitive in some ways.
But are you looking for any type of validation?
Yeah, maybe I am. I think I was. I don't think I am now. I think I've got to the point now where I feel real cynical. But maybe that's not true either. Because, like, if I go a couple of days and I haven't had a review of, you know, the book, and, I mean, the book's only been out a month, you're getting a lot of press about things. Like, it's like, well, no, everybody's forgotten about the thing, right? When that's probably not the case at all. You know, something's getting ready to be published, you know, in a day or two or, you know, whatever. But it's, yeah, I feel kind of disgusted by it, to be honest with you. Like, of that, like, do I want that? Where I knew once upon a time I did, right? Like, I wanted to take it by the collar and shake it. Because I think I'm so different than most of the writers that I know, right? Who've had really nice, come from really nice places, and they've had really nice parents, and they went to really nice schools, and they've done all the things that they're like A students. There are A students who are like writers as well. And you can see, you know, some of my friends who are writers are also not A students, right? Get that person in the room with the Whiting Award Committee or, you know, the MacArthur Grant, and that person's immediately going to turn off the room. Yeah, shoot, I'm just rambling now. Maybe you can read your next statement. We'll get to that.
There is a Sarah in real life.
Yeah, there is.
So what is your obligation to her,
yeah,
in these writings? Yeah,
exactly. I know. What is? Because it is, it's one of those things where I was married to a person named Sarah. I mean, so many of the things, like, you know, there's a birth date in the book that's not hers. There's, you know, a name in the book that's not hers.
You changed the name of her father.
Yeah, I changed the names of all of the people around her. The only names that exist that are still real is me, kids, her, at least first names, right? Friend, Chris, he's in the book. Left his name in there. So, yeah, you know, I guess it comes down to is this, you know, if the book, if I succeeded in what I was trying to do, so many times we look at this in fear, like as writers, and especially with audience. So many of my friends are like paralyzed with this fear of, you know, I'm taking advantage of people, or they're going to be upset by what I've done here. But that's kind of the answer of the book. If I've written a bad book, then yeah. But I think if I've written a good book, then maybe it's something different. Maybe it is presenting a version of someone that they would really love. You know, the real Sarah, I don't think she... I sent it to her to say, like, you know, here's my latest book. She was married to me while I was writing books about other people. She grew up with a mother who was a painter, right? Painters deal with the same thing, don't they? I've painted you from memory, or I've painted you as you sat for me. But how have I presented you, right? How have I portrayed you? It's a great story about Churchill. You know, that story of, I've drawn blank on the painter, but he's a great modernist painter, painted Churchill's portrait late in his life. And Churchill had it destroyed, or his wife had it destroyed after his death because he's troubled by it. Or the Picasso thing, you know, with Gertrude Stein, you know, where she's like, that doesn't look like me at all. And, you know, Picasso says, but it will, right? So if I've done that, if I've succeeded in that, then, you know, the ethics of all of that I could in some ways care less about. I could say I care about them, but I keep publishing these books, keep writing these books, so I must not care about that stuff that much. I have panic attacks over that sort of stuff, though, where it's like, I don't want to hurt anybody. I don't want to make anybody uncomfortable or upset by this very weird thing that someone does, you know, taking somebody and making up little stories or reporting or changing or completely changing the circumstances. So yeah, you don't want to hurt anybody, but yeah, you know, you still do it. So it's strange. It's a strange little sort of tight wire that you kind of walk.
Scott in the book has these moral questions extended out to everyday life, because we can think of ourselves as good, honorable people, how we deal with others.
Yeah.
But then we go to stores that support bad labor practices. We go to restaurants
exactly.
Support horrible anti-gay legislation. Yeah, we live in a country that bombs children.
Yeah, that's life, right? That's the nature of existence. It's the line from HUD, right? At the end where Lonnie's walking away and he's going to be a good person in his life, not like HUD, right? And Paul Newman tells him, your man's going to get your hands in it whether you want to or not, right? You're going to get in there. The image of Richard Nixon, popping, the final speech that he gives, which is a piece of art, right? Where he's like, Teddy Roosevelt, never mea culpa, but always in the arena, sometimes right, sometimes wrong, right? That's human existence. And I think I've been troubled by that. I think I'm still troubled by that. I think we're all troubled by that as well. So, I think a book in the scheme of things is probably
Or is this a rationalization?
Yeah, or is it a rationalization? People mess their kids up every day, right? Without writing books.
Without even trying.
Without even trying, they mess them up. That's always our joke. But Sarah, they can work. Sarah and I always say, they'll work it out in therapy one day. That's our joke that we say to one another. That if you look at that, that's incredibly twisted, right, to say that out loud. But the flip side of this is I would have loved, and I guess that's the reason why I've gotten so kind of close to writers or artists, you get to kind of see a little bit more inside of them from what you typically encounter of an individual. I would have loved to have had books written by my dad, right? Wouldn't that have been strange to be inside his mind? The only thing that I've had presented to me has been dad, right? And the backstory is essentially this mystery that I have. But it would have been probably incredibly painful at a particular point in my life to realize that, my dad robbed a store at some point in time, or that my dad beat my mom or whatever that I wasn't witness to. But yeah, it would have been incredibly fulfilling, though, at the same time to see, there was this other person kind of lurking in there all the time as well.
I heard stories about my dad, who was no saint, even in his dealings with me, but he'd drink a little too much and start mouthing off to people, and he'd get his ass beat.
Yeah, exactly.
And he wasn't some ass kicker.
Think how
he was
that
getting
would
his
have
ass
like
beat.
Messed with my mind when I was like 18. I thought, at that point in time where you're like, could I beat my dad in a fight? And at that point it was like, no, I think he could still kick my ass, if the chips were on the table. But how would it have destroyed me to figure out, when I was 18, that my dad just lost every fight, that he wasn't tough? That he was this little weak dude.
Well, he was tough. Yeah, he was just not a horrible fighter.
Yeah, I know. That's what I mean. It's
he was a pipe fitter. He just had a strong right arm.
That's right. How would that have changed the, circumstances? Just in hearing a story from somebody. So this is the thing. Gay Talese got in some trouble last year whenever that last book came out. Got some facts wrong in it. And,
is that the one about the motel?
Yeah, about the motel. And, how could you do this? And there's, again, this politics of 2017, which, is very suspicious of anything that has even a tinge of misogyny, even though misogyny is a human emotion in the same way that misandry is a human emotion, should be written about and will be written about. And there's no way we're going to eradicate it. But he said, I wrote because I'm reckless. Right? And I can't do this if I'm not reckless. And so, I've been reckless with things. And who knows what'll happen, right?
Now, since you're our official representative from the state of West Virginia today.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the least surprising political flip-flop in history.
Yeah.
Of
Jim Justice.
Jim Justice.
Yeah, good old Governor Jim.
Spending a whole 2 years in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I know. It's on one level, Jim Justice is from Greenbrier County, where I'm from.
Is that where Greenbrier, the presidential retreat
is? Yeah, that's where the Greenbrier's at, which he purchased. See, Greenbrier, and that's on the eastern end of the county. Western end is, hardcore, but, the eastern end, it sort of wants to be, Virginia or, something, or at least the idea of a Virginia. He's been a high school basketball coach. And there's a few politicians left like that. Joe Manchin has done something similar, where we've had these Democrats who have had to, just because our population's dwindled, West Virginia was a Democratic state for 60, 70 years, with Democratic governor, vote for the Democratic candidate.
Strong unions.
Strong unions. I mean, we helped create the 20th century, right, with the labor movement. Our people did that. They got their heads bashed in so you could have, your 15-minute break or whatever. But we've just had a population decimation. If you look at presidential election, 2004, people voted for Kerry, to 2008 with Obama, to 2012 with Obama too, to 2016 with Hillary. We've lost about 20,000 Democratic voters out of the electorate with each of those, of course, elections. The numbers are still the numbers. 1 in 4, you know, the white working class or whatever, they voted primarily the same numbers for Trump in the state of West Virginia that they voted for Romney, right? But yeah, you know, Justice, I think that, you know, Justice is probably doing it out of some sort of practical sort of survival kind of instinct in how he's going to be able to, you know, push policies in the state. What he was trying to do is he was trying to raise revenue by adding tax on cigarettes. We could have added our tax on cigarettes, and we could have upped the gas tax by like half a penny, upped the sales tax by like half a penny. Our financial problems would be solved, essentially, because our bond rating has been graded down. So he tried to do that, right? He tried to push that through, and he has a Republican House and a Republican Senate in the state who have all signed these ridiculous Grover Norquist bull tax pledges, so they can't even raise revenue by half a penny on something. So maybe it's some sort of political survival. Maybe he just smells it. I think most of them smell it there in the state that you're probably going to have to run as a centrist, you know, Republican, or at least a little bit to the right, rather than being a Democrat who's still running primarily the same sort of at least kind of political machine, right? Basically, common sense Republican in nature. So yeah, it's, you know, it's a complicated place. It is a complicated place. I hate that he's done that. I think there's going to come a time. It's just like with a bully, right? The Republican Party's big damn bully. Always has been. You know, you have to punch the bully in the face. And you know, I think Justice could have done that, right?
Well, I just saw a headline, and I don't know any more about the story than what I saw in the headline, that in 2012 he sold his coal mines.
Yeah.
For $600 million.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
Then bought them back for $5 million. And that was to companies from a certain country that,
yeah, exactly,
is in the news.
Yeah,
and so
exactly,
that raises a lot of questions,
yeah,
to me,
sure,
there.
For sure. Well, probably what happened to, see, Trump came and spoke to the Boy Scouts. We had the Boy Scouts Jamboree in southern West Virginia. And Justice rode down in the car with him from Charleston to Beckley. So I'm sure there were probably some conversations and some promises made in that car ride that allowed this to kind of happen here this week.
You have another project you're working on now? Or
yeah, I'm going to try to write a big old book. I'm going to try to write a big family book.
And, oh, the Buddenbrooks thing.
Yeah. So they were joking with me at the Fat Possum office the other night about Mein Kampf. But yeah, write something big, right? Write like a Bible or, you know, Holy Quran, you know, or something on that level.
Well, Scott, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today.
Oh, thank you.
Scott McClanahan is the author of The Sarah Book, which is a novel published by Tyrant Books. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.